When I walk around this terrier town, the one thing that gets me down is when people put bandanas on their dogs. It's time for the SAFTAcast, the only podcast that talks to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing, editing, or publishing. I'm your host, Scott C. Here we are, my friends, episode 68 of the SAFTAcast, and what an episode do we have for you today? It's a good one. That was a weird phrasing. That was an awkward pause there between two words. Anyway, let's barrel on, shall we? This episode is coming out right during the annual Writers and Writers Program Convention in Washington, D.C. The AWP 17 convention is on, and many writers, friends, and followers are there right now enjoying the sights, sounds, and the companionship that is AWP, and we would like to welcome those of you who are maybe traveling now on your way home, perhaps listening to this episode. You heard about us at the Sundress booth. Hi, new listeners. I'm Scott C. How are you doing? Good to hear. Anyway, as I said, what I like to do here at the beginning of the show is tell you the upcoming events from the Sundress Academy of the Arts and Sundress Publications, among other things. And what have we got? Well, we've got some information for you. Many things are abounding, but I want to take a moment here and really focus in on the podcast here today. Because if you're at AWP listening to us, or perhaps you are not at AWP right now, but on your travels home, you still have a chance to enter the SAFTAcast AWP Mugshot Contest. It's very simple. Take a photo of a cup of coffee. It can be any cup of coffee, anywhere during the convention. You don't have to be in the photo. It doesn't even have to be your cup of coffee. Take a photo, send it to us, either post it to our Twitter account, post it to Facebook at SAFTAcast on both of those. You can find us and tag us in so we know it exists. And you're entered automatically to win a prize pack from Sundress Publications, Sundress Academy for the Arts, and the SAFTAcast, which includes a SAFTAcast coffee mug of your very own. For full details, you can visit, of course, thesaftacast.com and click on Listener Contest. Now, something else coming up about our show. In March, we are about 1 month out now from our 3-year birthday, and it's going to be an interesting one this year, folks. We've already lined up a guest for it, and I don't want to tell you who it is, because it's a special guest, and it's, of course, going to be a good one, and we're working on a top-secret project of something you might be able to purchase for your very own domicile, but I don't want to give too much away just yet. I also don't want to belabor this opening too long, because I want us to get right to the episode, because it is a good one. Our guest this time, the one and the only, Ruth Foley, is on the program, and she has a lot to talk about, and we do talk about a lot of things, including her love of greyhounds, the two that she has, as well as her love for British comedy, specifically Monty Python, but all forms of comedy. We mention a few other, name-check a few of our favorites in there, as well as some of our favorite episodes and or quotes from them. We also talk about, and finally establish, which is the suckiest attraction to go visit on a tourist vacation, the Liberty Bell or Plymouth Rock. You'll find out soon enough, as well as about her adventures in screen printing. And of course, you can visit her Etsy shop at Sentimental Asylum. You do a search for her name, plus those words, you will find it. And keep a lookout from ELJ Publishing for her newest collection. Her first one coming out in just, well, should be coming out any day now. So keep your eyes peeled for that. But I'm not going to belabor the point any further. Let's just dive right in. The SAFTAcast, episode 68, with the one and the only Ruth Foley coming at you in about 31 seconds, because, of course, you gotta have the theme song. There we go. Now it seems to be working.
All right, cool.
Just, I'm hoping it does, because, oh, technology.
Indeed.
So how have you been, Ruth?
Good. Busy, but good.
Yeah, it's,
how about you?
About the same. Trying to hold water right now, you know.
Yeah.
Same boat as many of my friends, it feels like these days.
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of there are a lot of leaks happening, I guess.
A lot of leaks.
flooding. Choose your water metaphor.
Yeah, I think I can choose your water metaphor indeed. You know, be it drowning or treading water or taking a bath. I don't know.
Actually.
Washing dishes. Sprinkling the lawn. Anyway, Ruth, welcome. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
That's surprised that we haven't managed to hook up before this one and have you on yet.
Yeah, I don't know what you people were thinking, quite honestly.
Many people are asking that same question.
But no, I'm really happy. I'm happy to be doing it now.
Well, excellent. At least we have you. And let's start off. I always like starting off the episode with the burning question that is on everyone's mind.
Hit me.
And today's burning question is, what is the current background on your phone?
The current background on my phone is a very close-up picture of one of my greyhounds, Butler.
Oh.
Who likes to come and show that he needs me by putting his face very close to my face. Then he'll go step on my shoes, like, you should put these on now because we need to go somewhere.
You say one of your greyhounds. How many do you have?
I have two. The other one is Gracie. We got Butler. We had one before that. And when we lost him, we got Butler, and Butler had separation anxiety, which is a bad thing in a dog that's, you know, comes up to your hip and is 95 pounds. So we got Gracie to come and hang out with him, and it made a huge world of difference.
How old are they?
He's just about to turn 10, and she's 9.5.
Were they rescue dogs?
Yeah. Butler raced in Texas and then in Florida, because I'm in the Northeast and there's no racing up here in New England anymore. And Gracie only raced in Florida. But they get trucked up to out to various rescues, because otherwise they end up in just terrible, terrible situations.
I take it from the way you're talking, but are these your first greyhounds, or have you had ones before them?
We had one before Butler. He got to be pretty old. He was almost 13, I think, which is old for a dog that size.
How did you discover, like, greyhound rescues, or
was it? My husband is the king of all research. And so when we were first married, we were in an apartment and we couldn't have pets. And I grew up with cats. I was really, really missing having animals in the house. We had fish, which is not really the same, although they're pretty and I like them. But when we moved, when we bought a house and moved into it, one of the first things we did was start looking for dogs. And we wanted a dog that would fit the kind of lazy lifestyle that we enjoyed so much. And you would think that greyhounds would be really hyperactive and need a lot of entertainment, but really I don't know if it's because they've been raised in kennels and they're pretty much restricted most of the day or what, but basically they sleep about 23 hours a day, and they get up to eat and to go outside and to get petted, and then they go back to bed. And it's a great dog for a poet or a writer, because it's great to have the company, but they're not terribly demanding, but very affectionate.
They're like the cats of the dog world.
They really are. They call them 45-mile-an-hour couch potatoes. So they will find the softest space in the house, and that will be their space. The most comfortable bed, the best. My husband has allergies, so we can't have them on the furniture, but if they knew that they could get up on the furniture, you know, like, our favorite spots would be gone.
With the furniture excluded, then where did they go?
We have beds for them, but like, if there's a bed in a sunny spot on a winter day and there's a bed just kind of in the room, they will try to tease each other out of the bed that's in the sunny spot. Or if one of them thinks that the other one has a better blanket, they will, like, try to negotiate which one is in the better bed. And right now Butler has a bed that he really likes, and he's not happy if Gracie's in it.
Are they pretty active, though, when you take them out for walks or anything? I mean, I've had golden retrievers that will pretty much tear your arm off.
No, I mean, it depends, because, like, they're, you know, they're dogs, so they have their own personalities, but it depends on how keen they are, like how interested they are in hunting and racing, you know, running after prey, because they're taught to chase bunnies, right? So Butler, I think, might have just flunked out of racing because he doesn't care about small animals at all. And Gracie would drag you around. She'd when she was younger. They're both a little too old for that now. But when they were younger, she definitely knew where she wanted to go and wanted you to go with her.
You're right. The stereotype of the Greyhound is that of like a speed demon and, you know, just full of bouncing energy. So
it's... Yeah, no.
No, they're just couch potatoes.
They are. Although, you know, if you take them, you have to take them somewhere where it's safe for them to run. You can't, it's not because they're sight hounds. They can get, they'll hone in on a prey, which would be, you know, a squirrel or something like that, or a cat or a rabbit. You know, once you've domesticated the dog, and they're gone, and they can run, you know, 40 miles an hour when they're right off the track, 40, 45 miles an hour. And they get tunnel vision. They're just looking down those long noses that they have at their prey. And so they run straight across roads, or they'll run when you're running that fast. They're gone in 2 or 3 minutes. They're far enough away that they can't figure out how to get back. So they have to be, you can't just let them off leash and let them run around. They have to be somewhere fenced. Or when you do that, you can see that they were just made to run, and I don't think there's a happier sight on the planet than a greyhound who can just run.
So it's not like you can take them to, say, like Central Park or something, but a baseball diamond might be really good where there's a lot of fencing to kind of keep them penned in.
Yeah, it has to be totally fenced. It has to be completely fenced, because and the fence has to be pretty high because they can jump, and they're tall dogs. Like when Butler and Gracie were younger, it was not unusual for Gracie, when they were playing outside together, Gracie would just leap over Butler the long way, like from head to tail, just take one giant flying leap over him. So they learn how to climb fences. They do all kinds of stuff. So you just have to kind of know that that's a possibility and not be lazy about it.
I'm going to reiterate what I said. I think they are the cats of the dog world.
They totally are. They totally, totally are. And they're super, they have a reputation for being like standoffish, which I think is hilarious, because they will climb right into your lap if you let them.
And then basically it's like, you know, once I'm on the lap, it's like no other dog will get on here. It is only me.
Well, there's no room for another dog on me, for one thing. So there's that. Because, I mean, they're big. I mean, our dogs are... We've got big dogs for greyhounds, but even the small greyhounds are big dogs. So yeah, it's not like when I had cats, I could easily fit three cats in the chair that I was in with me, you know. You can't do that with greyhounds.
Do they get jealous then if one's in the lap and the other is not?
No. I mean, I have to be down on the floor with them anyway, but no, they don't seem to. I mean, Gracie will, like, if I'm petting Butler, I'll look over and Gracie will be on her back. Like, excuse me, I have a belly over here and nobody's rubbing it. But they don't tend to, like, try to push each other out of the way or anything like that. They just hang out.
It's like one knows, hey, you're getting the belly rubs right now. Look at me. But right. I'll get one eventually.
Right. And when you're ready, my belly is right here and it's good for rubbing.
They sound like awesome dogs.
They are awesome dogs.
Good to hear. I miss having a dog. I really do. I love the two cats we have, but I grew up with dogs, and so I miss having one.
See, I was talking to your wife the other day and saying that I miss having cats. I love dogs, and I think dogs are fantastic, and I would still have dogs. I wouldn't trade dogs for cats, but I miss being able to have cats.
Yeah, I miss not having the backyard to run, because there's no way I would have a cat in a small apartment. I mean, a dog in a small apartment.
You could with greyhounds, because they will just curl up into a tiny ball and they're super lazy. You take them out for a walk, you know, a good walk once a day, and like little trips out in the middle of the day and before bed and stuff like that. And they're great.
Maybe we'll hold off, but it's something to consider. I'd never considered, never considered a greyhound. I was thinking more like a basset hound type of thing, where it's a dog that has no brain.
Right. Well, basset hounds are adorable. I mean, there are very few dogs that I don't think are adorable. But yeah, I think greyhounds make great apartment dogs because they're so lazy. And we've got giant greyhounds, but they make them smaller. You can get pretty small dogs.
Yeah, I want one that's about 65 pounds. You got anything in that range?
Exactly. Yeah. 65 pounds is actually a pretty good size for a male. Butler is about 30 pounds over that.
They're just starting to get lazy and fat, basically, and they're happy.
Exactly. Although we haven't had a dog yet get fat. There are greyhounds that get fat, but Butler and Gracie don't.
Okay, not getting fat, but they're just happy to get all the food they basically want and laze around now.
Exactly. They're like, well, it's all milk bones and comfy beds from now on. This is pretty good.
Sweet retirement life.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's like, yeah, I did my running. I'm done with that now. Now I run when I want to.
Exactly. And they like being in the middle of things. They just like to be companionable. So they're used to having, 40 other dogs around with them. So they like being where you are. So it's, like I said, it's really great for a writer because you have the companionship, but there's not. Well, first of all, they're not walking across your keyboard like a cat will. But they just don't need a lot from you at specific times, so you can get a lot of work done. And then then they give you an excuse to get up and stretch and go outside.
Yes, the cat aerobics for the writer or anyone who uses a computer.
Exactly.
Learning the awkward positions of holding a laptop in your around you so that the cat does not get at you. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you respond to my message? It took me 50 minutes to write the word the.
Although I will say Butler, he licks the world. Like he licks the way, I don't know. I've never seen a dog lick like this, but he licks the way other dogs sniff. So when we first got him, he would walk through the house licking furniture and cabinets, just like as he walked past, he would just give them a quick lick. And then gradually the things that didn't move, he stopped licking. And we got Gracie and he licked her for like 3 days every time he passed her. And one thing that he does is he licks my laptop and I've got a touch screen. So I'll put I've got it on like a breakfast in bed tray, I usually work in the living room on the couch and I'll put it down and go into the kitchen and get, something to drink or whatever. And I'll come back and my screen has been zoomed 500%. Or sometimes he opens browser windows, like just because he decided on his way past he was going to lick my laptop.
Hopefully you don't walk in the room and say he's opened up a tab and it's like Milk-Bone Company or Nabisco or Purina.
Exactly. If he's like on Amazon buying milk bones in bulk, I'm going to know there's a problem.
Let's just get you a button, all right? We'll get you one of those button things. No, that would be a bad thing.
Yeah. He can't have thumbs, and he can't have one of those buttons because he'd just be hitting it all the time.
We're out of treats. No, we're not. Yes, we are. I know what it's like. I got suckered this morning. Our kitten, we're giving her wet food twice a day, and she suckered me this morning and convinced me that she didn't have breakfast.
They lie.
Oh, she got me good. My wife looks over and goes, are you about to feed the cat? I'm like, yeah. She's like, she just got her breakfast about 20 minutes ago. And I'm like, you little stinker. Opened the can.
When I was growing up, I had cats and we would leave notes for each other, like my parents and my brother and I would leave notes for each other. And if we needed to say that the cats had been fed, we would say the cats lie. Because they were just going to go after whoever came into the house and demand. Like they hadn't been fed in years. And
that's exactly what I did when I gave her breakfast for her first time when I was up early to go to work. I left a note saying she's had her breakfast. If she tells you anything different, she's lying.
Yeah.
But you grew up with cats, and you grew up in Massachusetts, right?
Yeah, I grew up in Foxborough.
Ah, right near Gillette Stadium.
At the time it was, it's been a whole bunch of different names, but now it's Gillette. It was Schaefer when I was a little kid. Nothing says football like beer.
So you basically grew up like right next door to the Patriots, then I'm assuming then you are a Patriots fan.
I'm absolutely a Patriots fan.
I want to say I hate you, but I also want to say my sympathies, but I'm a diehard Bills fan, and honestly, at this point, I got no hatred toward anyone.
Yeah. I mean, it's, what are you going to do with the Bills? One of my favorite things to do is to make fun of Rex Ryan, and I was all right with him getting fired, and maybe he'll actually get a coach who can do something with the Bills.
We won't. Ruth, I followed the team for about 25 years at this point. The average tenure is 2.5 years, and we haven't made the playoffs, so no.
They need to find somebody who will stick with their quarterback for more than, 15 seconds.
We need a whole new quarterback. As I say, I've said many times, let's just salt the earth in Buffalo and just move the team to Toronto. Start over.
It could be worse. You could be the Browns.
Even the Browns at least have something to hold their hat onto over the last few years.
Not this year, but you occasionally win games.
Okay, yeah. Guy. But you don't have at least one person every season trying to commit suicide in your stadium. We do.
But is that because of the Bills, or is that because of it being in Buffalo?
I want to say it's the Bills because it's in the stadium.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, you must be excited then for this weekend.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying. I don't talk trash. Like, I'm not going to. I think it's bad form to do trash talking. And I think it's bad luck. So I don't talk trash about the opposing team. But, yeah, I'm pretty excited about it.
Are you going to be doing anything special for it this year?
No, I teach on Monday mornings. I have to be in class at 9:30. So the late night, like staying up too late, is a little rough. And so if we were going out or entertaining or something, then that would make it even tougher. So I'm just hoping that I can wear my Patriots jersey to work. I've been, you know, ever since the Patriots started actually playing football, as opposed to the team that I grew up with, which was basically the Bills, I've wanted to wear my jersey to work, like after a Super Bowl win. And 2 years ago, right before the game, I said, ugh, you know, they're going to win. And my husband said, well, how do you know? And I said, they just canceled classes for tomorrow for a snow day. And that's what happened. So I'm trying not to get my hopes up too high, but I'm pretty excited about it.
Could be an interesting game. I don't have a deep investment in either team this year, but it could be an interesting one. I'm just tired of blowout games. And so the Patriots are known to do that. I'm hoping they'll maybe like scale it back, or the Falcons will step up.
Yeah. A good game is always better than a bad game. And close games are great when your side wins.
There was one, about 3 years ago. I can't remember who the teams were, where it was just back and forth Super Bowl. And I was in it. I didn't care even who won at the end. I was just like, I want this to go down to the wire. And it did.
That's the best. Unless you have a team in it and your team loses, then it's just painful. But if you guys win.
And I'm not referring to the Giants-New England game from a few years ago, although that one, sorry, I'm a little bit of a Giants fan. And
oh, no.
Can't help it, I'm a New York kid. So, and I gotta say, I enjoyed that one.
I think a lot of people enjoyed that one, but not us. I was teaching at a local university, a state school, during that game. And there was one kid in my class from Jersey who just had a field day. I had to go to class the next day, and he was basically unhinged with happiness and gloating.
I wish I had something to gloat about, but anyway, when it comes to that, I don't remember what happiness feels like watching sports anymore.
Yeah. One of my brothers-in-law is a Bills fan, and more power to you guys, really.
But I mean, what was it last year? We were so excited. The big news was we had broken 500.
Yeah.
Yay!
I've been there. The Patriots were that team when I was growing up. I've been there. So I'm not going to give you a hard time about your team's record.
Back when the Patriots were the red, white, and blue, and had the guy squatting. The Patriot squatting logo.
That's Pat Patriot.
It's funny.
The Flying Elvis.
Our local town high school in Binghamton, the Binghamton Central High, was the Patriots, and they ripped off the logo for their logo. That's how I always knew who the Patriots were.
I don't think I knew you were from Binghamton.
Yep. I'm from upstate New York. That's my home. That's why Buffalo is my team, because it's the only upstate team, the only New York team, really. So.
Right.
But you grew up in Foxborough and everything, and you're still there in Foxborough. Did you leave for a time and then come back, or have you just kind of always stuck close in Massachusetts?
I'm in Attleboro, so I'm not in Foxborough. I'm like two towns over. And I didn't go very far. I went when we were first married. We lived outside Boston for 4 years, but I was lucky enough to have been born like where I belong, I think. I've really never wanted to be in another part of the country permanently. I haven't found it. And I've been to a lot of the country. I think lots of it is lovely, but it's not where I belong.
What is it about Massachusetts that makes you feel like you belong there?
I think a lot of it is that I grew up in Massachusetts, and my grandparents, my dad's parents, had a house on the water of the Rhode Island south coast, so down kind of near the, not too far from the Connecticut border in Rhode Island. And so I grew up there, going there every summer. And it's just, I have to be close to the ocean. I don't think that the Pacific Ocean just doesn't feel the same. There's a very specific kind of, I don't know, Gorton's fisherman sort of quality to the Northeast Atlantic that you just can't get anywhere else. And I like the vaguely crabby Yankee kind of ideal. I think we have a reputation of being rude or being cold, and we're not. We're just, we take a little while to warm up, a lot of us. And I like that. I like being there when people warm up.
Like a dare I say, a saltiness to them?
Yeah. I mean, we're kind of jerks, right? Like we come across as jerks. Part of it is because it hasn't always been easy to live in this part of the country. Economically, it hasn't always been a great place to be. And part of it is just that almost Puritan standoffishness that we just can't seem to shake. But I'm telling you, when somebody like actually lets you know who they are, when a New Englander really opens up and is themselves, there, I don't think there's anything better.
So it goes from almost like, not cold, but like almost a standoffish, like stoic, to like the warmest, most cherished embrace.
Seriously, yeah. There's a great kind of, like, I don't think there's a better brand of sarcasm than New England sarcasm. I don't think that there's, I don't know, we've got a little bit of everything here, and I like it.
So. I hate to say dump on it, but I can kind of see where you get the attitude of, you know, rude people and everything, because I've been to Boston, been to Cape Cod, I've been through Massachusetts, I've been to, you know, to Plymouth and such. Great state, love it. I will also say that Boston driving is probably some of the worst driving I've ever seen. And I don't know, I'm going to preface that because I don't want to sound like I'm dumping on Bostonians. I think it's the way Boston is laid out as a traffic city.
Oh, that's a nightmare. I mean, when you let cows plan your roads, you're going to have problems when cars come along, which is what happened up here. You know, there's no grids. There's no way for you to know where you're going unless you know where you're going. And we don't help matters any by, like, not including traffic signs and things. GPS helps. It helps now that, you know, it's easier to get around because GPS can tell you where you're supposed to be. But in the days before GPS, it was a nightmare. I wouldn't advise anybody drive in Boston for any reason, pretty much ever. There's no reason to do it. And public transportation is pretty good. So,
what are some of the best things about Massachusetts? Like, if for someone that wants to visit, where would you send them?
Oh, it depends on what they want to do. One of the cool things about Massachusetts is that it's a small state, right? Like, you can get from one end of it to the other in a few hours, a couple hours. But if you want a kind of middle of nowhere beach, there are beaches down on the Cape that nobody really goes to. And then there are really sort of the kind of New England beach towns that you would think about if you're like from a movie or whatever. There's the city of Boston. You can go to Western Mass, and there's, well, we call them mountains because, you know, it's the best that we can do. It's not the Rockies, but there's skiing, there's big open expanses in some parts of Western Massachusetts. And then there's, if you want really artsy stuff, there's artsy stuff, and you can get to other places really quickly. So you can go to, like, from where I live, I can be in Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, or Rhode Island, all within about an hour to an hour and a half. It's hard for me to say, oh, you need to do this. I will say, don't go see Plymouth Rock. That's all I'll tell you. But I'm
not
going to go, because it's literally just the rock. It's a rock that they built a fence around, and it's like kind of in a depression, like it's in kind of a pit, and they've fenced it off because I think somebody was, I think there was a thing where people were like chipping off pieces of it, like it was the Berlin Wall. So there's a rock with 1620 carved in it, and it doesn't mean anything because it's not where the pilgrims landed. Somebody just decided that there would be a rock there, and there's a rock there. It's worse than the Liberty Bell in terms of giant letdowns.
And at least the Liberty Bell, you can look at it and go, well, that is a bell, and it has a crack
exactly.
in it.
And that's pretty much what you can do with Plymouth Rock. You can say, well, it's a rock, and it is in Plymouth, and it does have 1620 carved into it. And it's free, so there's that. You can look at the rock for free. If you had to pay to look at the rock, that would be even worse. But it's right next to the Mayflower too. The original Mayflower fell apart, but they rebuilt it. So there, I mean, there's other cool things to do in Plymouth, but you don't need to go see the rock.
At least the Blarney Stone has a legend behind it.
Exactly. Plus, the Blarney Stone makes you work a little bit. You know, you got to get upside down. You got to slide yourself in there. But Plymouth Rock. No, don't go to Plymouth just for the rock. Go for other things. Go for good seafood or to go to Plymouth Plantation or for the Mayflower or both, but don't go for the rock.
If you go to the rock, go only to watch people be disappointed because they went to the rock.
Actually, little kids disappointed all over the place by the rock. It's sad, really. Sad.
Shut up and watch this rock. Look at it. Look at it. That's history.
But it's really pretty down there because, you know, the harbor's right there and there's always boats and, you know, it's a good place to go, just not for that.
What are some of your personal favorite places in Massachusetts to go to?
Oh, wow. I'm such a homebody, Scott. It's hard for me to say. We've got, like, there's a couple of state parks near me that I really, really like. I'm actually more likely to go to Rhode Island because I'm right over the border. So I've got like a favorite Thai place and there are two other state parks in Rhode Island that I really like. And I like the coast, but Massachusetts, I think maybe I really like the Berkshires, which is Western Massachusetts New York border. It's pretty and funky and it's full of hippies and I like it out there. I haven't been out there in far too long.
Oh, it does sound like it's been a while. I think the last time I was there was when I went to AWP in Boston. And every time you go to AWP, you don't really get the chance to spend much time with the city or much other than the massive convention.
Yeah, and the weather that year was so awful, just like cold and icy. And
however, fun fact, that was my wife's first time ever experiencing snow.
Oh my God.
On that level.
Oh, wow. That wasn't even like a massive snowstorm or anything. That was kind of, that snowstorm was kind of half-assed. Can I say that on the Saftacast? Am I allowed to make mild swears on the Saftacast?
Oh, yeah, you can make whatever swearing you want, you know?
Oh, good.
Consarn it.
That is one I probably would not have thought of, but they are all in my vocabulary, so.
That and dang nabbit are two of my favorite seven curse words that I love.
I like dang nabbit and dang. I think dang is funnier than damn.
Do you find it's more fun to not curse and like just use non-curse words as curse words?
I'm a big fan of cursing. So I don't know. I like a good creative curse word. And I think that my favorite curse words take a bad word or a semi-bad word and pair it with a noun, just a regular noun, like douche canoe, I think is like just, it's much more fun to say. And you can do anything. You can get all creative with that kind of thing. But I do like not swearing. I like making it clear that I'm thinking about swearing and then not swearing. I do that in class a lot. Although I'm not above swearing in class. And we have a professor who loves to go into his first year writing class, or if he's teaching freshman seminar, he likes to go into classes with freshmen and just like, you know, these wide-eyed students who are still adjusting to being on campus and who maybe haven't been away from home before for any length of time, and everything is new, and and they're not quite sure what to expect. And he'll walk in, he'll just like strut into a room and toss his bag down and say, "How the fuck is everybody doing?" And they don't know what to do with it. Then I said, "Well, as soon as I found out that he does that, I'm like, well, I guess I'm all right."
That's a great story. I had a professor do something similar like that. That's the way he would open the semester, was to kind of, you know, jostle fresh-faced students who are just out of high school, including myself. Anyway, though, that's been a long time since I've been in Mass. Beautiful state, though, from what I recall. It was when I was a teenager, so it's been a while.
Yeah, it is. It's beautiful. And it's beautiful. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of winter, which makes Massachusetts maybe not the best place for me to be, but winter is beautiful. Like, every single, we have, get all four seasons, and they're all gorgeous in their own way. There's a specific color of green that only shows up in very, very early spring, and, you know, everybody talks about the fall, but every season in New England is just gorgeous. It's a beautiful state.
Definitely do make it sound like that, and if I do make it up there sometime, then I keep saying that on the show here. It's like every guest I talk to, it's like, one of these days I'm going to get out to Texas. I'm going to get to Ohio. I'm going to make it to California. Man, I wonder if
get
I'm...
out more, really. That's the theme I'm hearing here.
Is what?
You got to get out more.
I got to get out more. Yeah, I'm like writing traverse checks my butt can't cash.
Yeah.
You're here on the Saftacast. They've got the traverse checks there. Oh, that's an obscure reference.
Did you seriously just make an American Express joke?
I just did. I shouldn't know that. I'm
You're too young for that.
I'm too young for that.
I mean, I'm almost too young for that, and I'm way older than you are, so, yeah.
I'm going to blame Mystery Science Theater for that.
Well, you can blame Mystery Science Theater for an awful lot of what should be obscure pop culture knowledge.
Yeah, you know, you're right. A couple of months back, I remembered a line that Joel Hodgson said, and it led me down a wormhole of learning about Red Goose shoes online and like,
yeah, yeah, they did. MST3K, they do or did or will be doing again an amazing job of piling on the pop culture references. And they come so fast that, you know, I've watched a bunch of them multiple times and still catch new stuff. What's your favorite one? Do you have a favorite?
I have a few favorites I keep coming back to. I love EGA.
Well, yeah, how can you not?
I don't know why, but I love the stupidity of that episode. And then I have ones that are personal favorites because I watched them with the right people, and they bring back good memories, like Catalina Caper.
See, Catalina Caper was the first one that I saw because we didn't have, I think it was on the Comedy Channel before it was Comedy Central. Whatever it was, we didn't have it, but my brother had it. And so they made a VHS recording of Catalina Caper, and we watched it together. Me and my husband, we weren't even married yet. We were dating, and, my brother and his wife, and we watched it together, and we brought it back and, showed it to our friends, had like a viewing party to show it to our friends. So I like Catalina Caper just has, I don't think it's the best episode by a long shot, but it has a very special place in my heart because it was the first one that I'd seen.
I feel that way about Killer Leeches. That was my my entrance point. I may have told the story on the show before, but this is how I got it. Was we had just gotten Comedy Central on our cable system, and I'm flipping through the channels. I'm like 15 years old, and I caught the host segment of We're a Danger to Ourselves and Others, and I looked at it watching this guy in puppets, and I'm like, what the hell is this? So I grabbed a VHS tape. I always had a VHS tape with blank space on it, slammed it in, and caught the last half hour thinking, this will never be aired again.
Right.
And right. I tune in. Unfortunately, the next week was The Killer Shrews, which is one of the worst episodes to
watch.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a kind of painful one.
That was my introduction, and so that July night, and since then I've never stopped watching. But other than Catalina Caper, what's maybe a couple of your favorite episodes of that show?
I have very fond memories of watching the Pod People, and we will make all kinds of, like, my friends and I will make all kinds of references to the Pod People. We'll just like quote lines or repeat things from there. And Mitchell. Mitchell is genius. We sing the theme song to Mitchell on a fairly regular basis around the house.
So Mitch, I can definitely agree with Mitchell and pod people as well. Whenever I'm cooking potatoes, I'll just start grabbing them and going, "Ooh, little yellow potatoes.
Oh, winged potato." Yeah, we'll do that too. My nephew Joey can do a really good impression of that voice, and he'll just haul it out for no apparent reason every once in a while.
I've shot Trace a message once on Twitter trying to find out what that's from, and I cannot find any answer to that.
Yeah,
if that's making fun of a specific voice or bit somewhere. I can't get anything on that one, but
I don't know. It's one of those things. Like, I grew up on Monty Python, right? Monty Python's Flying Circus, and it was years before I realized, first of all, that Terry Jones wasn't putting on a funny voice; he was just Welsh. Like, I was a full-grown adult before I realized that he wasn't just being, like, goofy with his voice. That's how he talked. And I had the same kind of thing happen. I realized, I was, again, a full adult before I realized that a lot of what I think of as, like, funny Monty Python voices are actually just them trying to do American accents.
I never thought of that, but I think you're right.
Yeah, they're doing it like there's like a Crelm toothpaste ad, you know, and it's completely supposed to be an American accent, and it's an awful American accent. And I kind of thought that they were making fun of some British thing that was going over my head.
The only one I can think of is there's the one with the marriage counselor where John Cleese is a cowboy. He gets Eric Idle out there. He's just like, "A man's got to do what a man's got to do." And then the caption comes up, "So much for pathos."
Exactly. But yeah, watch them again and watch like any of the... It's often like the ad segments that they would do, like the little cartoon Terry Gilliam ads. And it's often Eric Idle. And it's a terrible, terrible American accent. It's great.
I will have to pull a few of those up, and I never thought about it that Terry Jones is Welsh, so it's not him putting on a fake posh London accent, but it's just him.
He's not like, ooh. No, it's just that's how he talks, because he's Welsh.
I keep a playlist on YouTube of just like things like that, so that I don't lose my mind sometimes. And you know, like the Hungarian phrase book sketch, I will pull up every now and then. Just waiting for the day when I can get into a conversation at some point and honestly be able to say, "Drop your panties, Sir William. I cannot wait until lunchtime."
Ours is usually, "My hovercraft is full of eels." We'll say that a lot.
If I ever get arrested, though, I will make sure I scream out, "My nipples explode with delight."
Delight. Exactly. You're killing me.
it's always good to meet someone who enjoys Monty Python. Did you watch it when it originally came to the U.S., when it was just on PBS?
Yeah, I watched it on PBS. I was way too young, because I think it came to PBS in like 72, 73, something like that. And we got the Boston PBS station, which, you know, got like cutting edge British stuff, because it was Boston, and WGBH. It was sending programming all over the place. But I was like 4 or 5 when it showed up here. We were allowed, my brother and I were allowed to stay up late. It ran on Sunday nights at 8, I think, and we were allowed to stay up until 9 because my dad wanted to make sure that we got like a good solid grounding in British humor. But then we were not allowed to watch Benny Hill because that was too late.
What's odd is that I started with Benny Hill as a kid.
Oh. Huh.
Because I can't remember. He used to be on one of the local cable channels, because where I lived in New York, we could pick up WBSK, and my dad would let me watch Benny Hill. I didn't understand the sexy humor. I just liked the old guy and patting him on the head and running around in fast motion. I thought that was hilarious.
I did not understand most of Python that I was watching when I was a kid. I understood like the absurdist and ridiculous stuff, like the fish slapping dance, you know, and you don't have to be a brain surgeon to figure out why the fish slapping dance is funny.
You got a decent grounding then, British humor. I know what you're saying too. As a kid, I started watching Python when it was on MTV for a brief time.
Oh my gosh. And yeah, so you're like 10 years younger than I am, right?
Yeah, thereabouts. I started watching it there, and I was attracted to the visual silly humor, and it's only as I got older that I was like, Okay, the philosophers playing soccer is brilliant.
Yeah. So much of it.
See,
The
you.
Upper Class Twit of the Year Awards, the competition is fantastic. It's just, it's there, it's great stuff.
Oh, it is. I discovered them, and then it was like maybe 2 or 3 years later that I discovered what became more of an influence and supplanted Python for me was the Kids in the Hall.
Oh yeah. I still have that whole series on DVD. Like when it came out on DVD, I bought it all. Yeah, I love the Kids in the Hall. And those skits show up in our conversation all the time.
Oh, very often, much more than probably MST with me, is I'll think of a line like now I'm blanking on it, but now like Bruce McCullough yelling, "Mr. Bus Driver!"
We do a lot of the Bruce McCullough songs around here. We do the "Stop the World," "We Broke Up," ding, 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 ding. We'll sing that, or the
Country
Terrier.
music.
We sing Terrier song. We do a lot of that stuff. Fine ham abounds. I'd say that.
It sounds like me, like Ruth, you got a really good grounding in comedy. Has that stuck with you?
I mean, without comedy, what's the point?
Do you keep up with like what's current on TV? Are you still seeking out or say British humor? Your dad insisted that you get raised on that. Do you keep up with like BBC America and British comedy?
I like British comedy a lot. We don't get BBC America, which makes me really sad. It means that we're like a year behind on Doctor Who, and I have to wait for stuff to show up on Netflix and Amazon Prime and stuff like that. But I love British humor, and I love really good comedy in general, but my favorite stuff is shows that are funny. Like, I think sincerity is just the funniest thing in the world. Like shows that are playing comedy for comedy usually fall pretty flat with me. Like, I don't want to diss any of the shows, but there are shows that are on TV right now that I'm just not into. But I love shows that where everybody is, the comedy is coming out of, it's character driven, and it's coming out of who these people are, and life is ridiculous and life is funny, and so they do ridiculous and funny things and it's funny. So like Parks and Recreation has a moment in it every episode that makes me laugh out loud, just every single time, guaranteed, and it's usually something ridiculous.
It just has to be like a humor that's grounded in reality.
I think it can't be too self-aware. Like, it can be absurd. Like, Archer is completely absurd and completely wrong. It's wrong on every level. I don't know if you've seen Archer, but it's like everything about it is just, it's like everything that I'm against, right? It's like misogynist, and it gets its humor from all kinds of places, but they're all so sincere about it that I can't, I, it's funny. Archer's another show that makes me laugh, even though I want to be horrified by the whole
I
thing.
know the feeling. There are moments on there where I'm like, did I just laugh at that? Yes, I did.
Yeah, yes, I
And I'm
did.
okay with laughing at that.
Yes, I did. BoJack Horseman is another one that where it's BoJack Horseman is like the most recent season ended just with so much. There's so many feels there, right? There's so much emotion there, and it was funny all the way through. And I'm not quite sure how they pulled that off. And it's ridiculous because he's a horse. So it, I mean, clearly it's not, it's, I don't have to be grounded in reality, right? Like, there's all kinds of animal people on that show. But the people themselves, the characters themselves are 100% who they are. And Mr. Peanut Butter is one of the best comic characters, I think, ever, ever, because he's so sincere.
I hate to say that I haven't seen it yet, but it is
Oh!
on my hit list.
No, right now. We have to end this interview right now because you have to watch it.
This is the curse of being pop culture savvy this day and age, is that there's just so much.
Oh, no, you have to drop everything.
Okay, I will make that a higher priority then. I'll put that above The Expanse right now, which is
Top
also
priority. Top
okay.
priority.
I will keep that in mind. Before we let you go, Ruth, I really, really wanted to talk to you for a couple minutes, at the very least, about Sentimental Asylum. and your creation of this, which is now just seems to be like just keeps taking off bigger and bigger with each month for various reasons, external and internal. So let me start with this. How did you start making t-shirts and various screen printings of things?
It starts in a really, really sad story, which is, I started out block printing. I was making block prints rather than screen prints, and I still do. But I had a cousin named Turquoise who died very young. She got cancer. It went undiagnosed, and by the time she could get somebody to actually pay attention to her symptoms, she had secondary liver cancer, and the survival rate there is just tragic. And she and I grew up together. We were very, very close, and it took me a really long time to get through it. And she was in California. We had always had a written correspondence because we grew up before the internet, mm-hmm. and long distance phone calls were a thing that existed. So we wrote to each other all the time, and just like these ridiculous, funny things. And when it was clear she was dying, and I would go looking for cards to send her, and I couldn't find anything because they were like, you would think you would get a Cope card, right? Like, but those were all, they all have pictures of babies, which she wasn't going to have, or old ladies, which she wasn't going to be. And the, a get well card isn't appropriate. And so I would go out, I'd go looking, and then I'd go sit in the car in the parking lot and just sob. Like I couldn't find anything. And so I was talking to a colleague at work one day about it, and he said, we should make them. I said, I wish I could just have a card that said, you know, this totally sucks, but, and I don't know what to say to you, but I'm here. And he says, oh, we could make them. And he had been doing block printing. So he got me interested in block printing. And then I decided to try block printing on fabric, and I made a big block that said, read a book, motherfucker, that I thought was really, really funny. And I didn't think anybody would, you know, want it, but they did. And so I sold a couple of those. And then this same friend of mine, he and his wife and my husband and I took a screen printing class at this like kind of artist collaborative makerspace in Providence called AS220. Then for my birthday, maybe for Christmas last year, I don't remember, my husband bought me like a home screen printing kit, like just because he figured it would be something that we could do for fun. And then the next thing I knew, we were making t-shirts and aprons and tea towels and whatever else people want me to screen print things on. And the screen printing and the clothing end of thing has really kind of become its own beast.
Yeah, it's definitely brought you some recognition, I'll say that. In good ways, too. I mean, I don't know what the technical rules are of saying this as a host, but I do own one of the aprons, a teacup that says dainty as fuck. And that's my kitchen apron, although I have yet to wash it, and there is like a chocolate stain on it that is probably like three layers deep into the thing now, but it's all right.
It'll wash up just fine. Those things wash beautifully, well, so you'll wash it.
I'll trust in it, but I do want to ask you, though, like, what would you consider to be your personal favorite one that you've done? Not necessarily your bestseller or the one that people request the most, but what's... Personally, can you even name what you think is your favorite design so far?
I have an Indian block inspired fish, and I just made it for myself. So it's definitely not a bestseller. It's just like a white Indian block print, so it's very kind of intricate. It's just a single fish, and it's right below the neckline of a maroon t-shirt. And I wear that one pretty much every week. I wear that one. But the screen prints, I mean, the first screen print that we started selling was the Loch Ness Monster one, the Nessie t-shirt that says believe in yourself underneath it. And it still makes me laugh. And I love doing We do like toddler t-shirts and onesies, or I guess I should call them bodysuits, because onesie is a brand and we don't always use the brand. So we do these little, you know, one piece bodysuits for infants, and we call them tiny. So I got to do a tiny Nessie, or we have a design that says not today patriarchy, and we call it the tiny patriarchy tees. And those, every single time I pull the screen off of the fabric and I just start laughing. Because they're just so hilarious. They're just these tiny little things.
I love the idea of that's one of the reasons I would have a child, is so that I could just dress them up in, you know, single piece outfits with slogans on them. One of my favorites I ever saw was it used to be in the old Zappa, Frank Zappa store before the family and issues were there, but it was a t-shirt or maybe a full bodysuit that just said titties and beer on it.
Yeah, see, that's totally wrong, and everybody needs one. I have one that says, one of my friends said, you need to make a read a book motherfucker onesie, like for babies. And I said, oh, wow, yeah, maybe I should do that. And then she goes, no, wait, read me a book motherfucker. And I was like, oh, well, we're doing that right now. We're making that right now. So I like that one a lot. I like the idea of a baby swearing.
That is... It's great. I for one will say I always look forward to new designs and what you're going to come out with next, as well as just seeing where these products wind up. You know, photos from people saying like, here, I wore this and, you know, at the top of a mountain in California.
Yeah, it's pretty. I have the Not Today Patriarchy one. And so obviously that was really popular right around the election. I made a ridiculous amount of them in the couple of weeks before the election and the week or so after the election. And it's still the most popular design that we've done. And on election day, people were wearing them into the voting booths and taking pictures of themselves, you know, with the I voted sticker. And it was just taking pictures of their kids wearing the tiny patriarchy keys. And they were posting them and tagging me, and my phone just kept going off. And it was amazing to have them. They've gone to, I just sent one to New Zealand. Like it's so wild. It's so incredibly wild. And the, we decided that we would start using the money we were generating from the political t-shirts, the feminist t-shirts and the other political t-shirts, to start supporting causes. And so we've been able to send a fair amount of money to progressive causes that we believe in, which is really important to us too.
And it's amazing to think, it's like, this is a line of poetry and writing that you wouldn't expect, but this may be the only area where it pays off, maybe. But
exactly. I'm actually making money by writing things. Who knew? Poets aren't supposed to do that.
But you never know. You can also make royalties on books, and that is definitely something on your horizon, I know.
It is. It is.
When your first full length is coming out.
Coming out from ELJ Publications, and really... I don't have a copy of it yet, but I'm any minute now it's going to be out. So it's called Dead Man's Float. It's about or it's centered around fake letters, poems, epistolary poems, letter poems that I wrote to Turquoise in the last couple of months before she died and right after she died. So those kind of work as a thread throughout the book. And yeah, it'll be out. It's going to be out like within the next week or two, from what I understand.
Excellent. Well, when it drops, if it hasn't already dropped by the time this episode goes live, then we will definitely post about it and let people know that it's out, because this has been a long time coming and a lot of people expecting it, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. I mean, it's been over a year since it got accepted, and I'm really, really proud of it. I think I wanted the poems to end up in exactly the right place. It was important to me that they ended up with the right publisher, not just any publisher, and that they ended up in the right hands. So I'm really proud of it, and I'm excited to have it out in the world.
Excellent. Well, we will look forward to that, and as well as any other work that you may have coming up on the horizon. I'm sure right now with teaching, with Sentimental Asylum, with book promotion, probably maybe not thinking of the next book or next series at the moment, but
yeah, nothing. I'm working on some stuff. A poet friend of mine said that she broke her writer's block by just writing poem for after the end of the world at the top of the page, and then poems started coming, and I started doing that. So I've been generating some new material, which is kind of good. I was worried for a little while. But yeah, new stuff is coming down the pike.
We'll see what happens as it comes out. But before we let you go, Ruth, as always, got to find out, where can the folks find you online and want to check your stuff out?
If they want to find my poems, or they want to find the shop, or they want to find me.
Let's start with where can they find Sentimental Asylum? Because we talked about that first.
Sentimental Asylum, probably the best place to find it is on Etsy. I do all the sales from Etsy. So it's Etsy.com/shop/sentimentalasylum, all one word. Or you can also search for my name and I'll probably pop up there. The book is going to be at ELJ. So ELJ Publication or ELJ Editions. And in a little twist, Sentimental Asylum did the book bags that ELJ is giving, the tote bags that they're giving to their authors. So we printed those, we designed those and printed those. So that's going to be like clash of worlds. I'm pretty sure that when my books come, they're going to come with my own tote bag in the box, which is going to be kind of cool.
Wait a minute. Didn't I print this and send it to you? And why didn't I just keep it?
Exactly. And so Sentimental Asylum has a pretty good web presence. Sentimental Asylum has there's an Instagram, there's a Twitter account. I have my own Twitter account, so I'm pretty easy to find. And most of my Facebook stuff is public, so you could hunt me down that way too.
Awesome. Well, I hope our fans do that have listened to this episode. If they are not fans of you already, I hope they are, because Ruth, it is totally awesome to chat with you.
Fantastic. It was great to talk to you too.
And if I am ever at AWP again, I'm not going to be there this year, but who knows, maybe in Tampa next year. But if I'm ever up in the Northeast again, believe me, I will look you up.
Oh, if you're in the Northeast again, you're staying here. Good thing.
All right. Well, take care. Have a great evening, Ruth. We'll talk to you soon. And good luck to the Patriots from a destroyed Bills fan.
Oh, see, I know how hard that was for you to say. I appreciate it all the more.
I just hope I don't get attacked now for having said it.
It's okay. I'll protect you.
The SAFTA Cast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.